Hello and welcome back to Podcast From the Edge with me, Peter Bruce. Just 3 weeks, or 3 weeks and a bit, left for the election, and to be honest, I can't wait. I'm way past tired of being told it's the most important election since the dawn of democracy in South Africa. It may be, but we'll only know in about 10 years' time. You know, we know now, for instance, that Jacob Zuma getting a second term in 2014 was much more important and momentous than Cyril Ramaphosa getting a first term in 2019. Whether or not elections matter tends only to be clear much later, or very often. A little like the story of the visitor who asked the Chinese leadership in 1968 what they thought of the French Revolution, and they said it was too early to tell. So let's not stop breathing here. We should go out and vote and live with the results. That's how we do it, and in proper democracies all around the world, for that matter. And in a sense, our democracy matters much more than the results of its elections. I thought of this when I read Peter Attard-Montalto's column this Monday. Peter is an analyst, an economist, and a senior partner at Krutham, an excellent and proactive South African-led consulting firm. He knows this country's political elite like the back of his hand, and his Monday columns in Business Day are always crunchy and, for me, required reading. So, Peter, thanks for joining me here. There's an almost throwaway line in your column this week that people, for some reason, always forget during moments of high South African drama like this election campaign, where we tend sometimes to lose our heads a bit. You said that markets underestimate just how conservative the ANC national executive is, and that's so true. In fact, we may just be a very conservative country. Why do you think that that matters?
Well, I think when you look at what they've actually done, as an NEC, as a body that can kind of do whatever they like in terms of directing government, forming a manifesto, you end up with this remarkably conservative fiscal policy that we now have at the moment. That gets discussed a lot inside the NEC. It would be a slight step too far to say it gets approved. But there's certainly, you know, keen interest inside the NEC on what goes on in government, what goes on with things like fiscal policy, what goes on in terms of reforms, you know, NECOM, NLCC, these crisis recovery committees. And they allow it to happen. If, and, you know, if you want to have this view of them being sort of crazy left-wing, entity, that doesn't live up to the facts in terms of what actually comes out. Now, you only see that crystallized every so often. Remember the last policy conference in the middle of 2022. A big shift there in terms of allowing the public sector to partner with the private sector, giving up the ghost somewhat on the state-led growth. That came out very much in the manifesto as well. And so, yes, I think, you know, when you strip it all back and actually compare the manifesto of the ANC to the DA, excluding some of those, you know, issues around the edge like prescribed assets and empowerment, there's actually a remarkable amount of similarity now, unlike, say, last election and election before that.
And it's in our social life as well, isn't it? I mean, you know, one of the things that Jacob Zuma stood up and said now in his new guise as leader of the Mkhonto we Sizwe party was that he was going to send pregnant schoolgirls to Robben Island. I mean, that's not, you know, there's nothing progressive or radical about that. And I think social policy-wise, the ANC is still a very conservative organization.
Oh, indeed. And you can see that from the courting of religious groups. Respect for constitutionality, for sure. I think we've seen, obviously, while a lot further to go, there has been some realization of progressive rights under the Constitution. Arguably not enough, obviously, if you don't have enough clean running water and reliable electricity going around the place. I think there is a broad, as you say, small C conservativeness to the party. And that's why then in this election, you know, there is a broad sweep of obviously more left-wing parties that would be quite hard actually to join up with, given what it would mean in terms of, you know, coalition agreements with the EFF, MKP, and the like. And that's why we don't see, and we don't get the vibe certainly from the ANC, that those sort of coalition agreements on the left are more possible.
In fact, you talk about the results of this election not being not completely unknowable in the sense, and I think you're talking about the conservatism there again of the ANC NEC, because although they're under pressure, they're not going to, you know, tell me whether I'm putting words in your mouth, but I mean, the likelihood of them, even under pressure, producing a national central coalition government with the EFF have got to be close to zero.
They're low. I mean, the problem here in looking at the NEC, and we talked to a lot of NEC members, is there's a visceral distrust of the EF for sure, across large parts of it. But there are also people who like the EFF for sure, but that gets overplayed. I think a lot of people in the business community, like to talk about how close Paul Machatile is to the EFF. That has an element of truth to it, but people vastly overplay that point, I think. And, it's the same thing in terms of who's anti-DA. There's certainly some anti-DA elements in the NEC, but I would say that the balance of the NEC is much closer to the DA, though they wouldn't admit it in public, than to the EFF. And I think the other thing to consider as well, on this front of tie-ups, is the ability to see stability. I mean, I think the NEC values stability. They remember what happened with Des Van Ruin and with that weekend. These NEC members are not poor. They have often retirement funds. They have equities. They know about markets to some basic degree. And I think that does play into their thought process on this, to some degree at least.
Yeah, it's good that people have skin in the game, something to lose. They're going to make decisions in their own interest, one would hope.
But I just want to come back on your point on there being unknowable. I think this is important. I think far too many, particularly local investors, have thrown their hands in the air and said, we don't know, it's impossible to say, we can't possibly know. Whereas often a lot of offshore investors are very used to dealing with very close, very contentious elections. And we keep telling people, follow the maths. If you just think about some basic outcomes of the election, some different scenarios, you introduce a bit of a rank preference order of coalition partners, you get relatively few outcomes, actually, and quite a lot of quite a lot of sensitivity in the vote outcome for the ANC actually leads to status quo. If you start thinking through the combinations of coalitions, you can still actually get status quo policy out. Not that's great, of course, but we talk about avoiding downsides under a lot of different scenarios. And that's why we push back quite strongly against this idea that somehow we don't know anything about the outcome of the election. We don't believe that.
Yeah. Is there a danger because of that belief? Then there's probably less danger, you're saying, of the markets overreacting to an EFF-ANC coalition not happening. In other words, they're kind of a relief rally. That's not going to happen because they would already understand that that's unlikely.
Well, I think offshore investors certainly are already understanding that balance of risk. Onshore investors, I think, are still overpricing the risks of an EFF coalition. I think we see some potential for some rally after the election. Again, I wouldn't overplay that in the sense of things will be very noisy regardless of who's in there. If it's a DA, if it's a smaller party coalition, there's going to be noise. And that's naturally what you get for the terrain. But also, I think there's obviously, and we've discussed this here before together, I think, an underappreciation by the market that we are on the path out from load shedding, albeit it's slow. We are on the path to solving logistics, albeit that's painfully slow. I think that realization, that reassessment, the same for fiscal, as I said in the column, will also come about after the election. So, we can get the South African markets on the front foot to a little bit.
Yeah. Well, I just want to come back to those points you're making. Load shedding appears to be slowly being solved. You're satisfied that Eskom isn't burning any more diesel that it needs to keep the lights on ahead of the election. It doesn't seem as if it might be.
Well, indeed, load factors are quite low. We're operating at roughly 5% load factors for OCGTs at the moment. That compares to sort of 25% in Q2 last year. And actually, demand is pretty weak. I mean, we believe a growth, given this uncertainty, is quite weak in the first half of the year. And that seems to be coming in the demand profile that we're seeing, and the slight higher EAF as well at the margins. But we think the government and Eskom overplay that EFF turnaround story a little bit.
Well, I mean, is this interesting? Because you can track the EAF every week on Eskom publishes it, and I think it's still averaging for this year below 60%. Although every now and again they might hit an afternoon where they crack 65% for an hour or two, and then it gets reported. But the weekly EAF figures, the latest one is still below 60%. And I just wondered whether the demand falling off is simply not, where the demand isn't necessarily falling off, but simply that it's been directed elsewhere. In other words, it's being demanded of solar, and Eskom is feeling the relief of that, or Eskom isn't having, because it doesn't get to Eskom. So people are using solar power, renewable energy in one way or another.
Oh, indeed. But we factor that in already. So we can model that quite clearly from the ESCOM data they publish, from imports of PVs and batteries. But it's even after accounting for that, we think underlying demand is lower. But no, that step up in 1.5 or gigawatts in the last sort of 9 months or so that we've seen in rooftop PV is still continuing. We think that trend will continue for another year or so.
Peter, what does it mean for us? Off the discussion slightly, but what does it mean then when we were able to have no load shedding for almost a month now, with an EAF of less than 60%? That's, why bother trying any harder to get 70% or 80%? I mean, if Eskom can function for the country now, given the state, given 58% or whatever it might be, that's got to be good news, because the rest of us can get on with our lives now and we can use our solar power and assume that there's now time and space to produce other kinds of energy in South Africa.
Oh, indeed. And let's not forget that SMMEs are not buying diesel at the moment in the same way they were last year. Profit margins will be higher. Tax take will be higher. But we should be a little cautious. We think load shedding will return, but we are on an off ramp. We're going to have about 12 terawatt hours of load shedding this year after 24 last year, down to about 7 next year. We model this very closely. We are on this off ramp. The real issue here is how you then sequence decommissioning of power stations, independent of the climate issue, but just because, demand is being satisfied elsewhere through aggregators, the demand for green electrons given CBAM. And that's a discussion that people still don't want to have, fully. And, I think that's an important discussion we'll have, as we get to lower stage of load shedding into 2025.
And just come to the logistics, Peter. You also slow progress, you say, there in your column. Is the serious work that you're talking about? So there's serious work, you say, going into solving the logistics crisis. What can you tell us? I mean, is the serious work in the presidency, in the working groups with business, or is it happening at Transnet? Because Transnet is where it matters. I mean, do they have the right leadership in place? Do they know what they're doing? How do they get their rail pricing, their concession pricing so wrong if they really do know what they're doing?
Well, I think you have to remember a new model is being created, and that's the vision in the freight logistics roadmap. I had to declare a little bit of conflict. I've been very involved in some of these processes, and maybe that's why we're a little positive. I think what we're seeing around logistics, which is really interesting, is this new vision and mindset that's coming out. What it basically means is you've had a regulator intervene. IREC, the interim regulator, has said, basically to Transnet, the market, what's going on here? How do these prices come about? And you've then seen Transnet react in the media, right, to say, okay, actually, we might be able to lower the tariffs. And that's how a system should work, right? And that's how you provide certainty to the private sector, to crowd in financing, to crowd in investment. So it's a very interesting example of how you can create an entire mindset change just by introducing what is, to be honest, a pretty under-resourced regulator in IREC, but it's making a difference. And I think that's really important to point out.
And this guy, the person, the regulator at the moment, is an acting regulator. There's structures that need to be created and all those kind of things, if I'm not mistaken, am I right?
Yep. So IREC is run by Jan-Louis Balestra, who is a rail and Transnet veteran, very well respected both in the public and the private sector. But yes, over time, IREC will move into a broader transport regulator. That bill is just going through the NCOP, nearly done now. And yes, we'll get a much clearer vision. The other thing to mention is we're sucking, the roadmap sucks some of these quasi-regulatory powers out of Transnet. That process is ongoing with infrastructure manager and how that's been set up, the corporatization of TNPA. So it's all about removing some of those monopoly instincts, right, which can, come to bear and actually block out the private sector, as we saw most famously, of course, with this pausing of REAP in 2014. And I think that's where the authors of the roadmap have been very careful about system design. It's about tackling mindsets and ensuring there's a level playing field, ultimately, for the private sector to be able to operate.
And Peter, you talk also about fiscal outcomes being better than expected. Just tell me briefly what you mean.
So if we think about the 23-24 fiscal year, say 2 years ago, the market was forecasting a primary deficit for that year, maybe about -0.1, -0.2. The budget then last year, was a little over-optimistic. on that front. They scaled it back and said there'll be about a 0.3, 0.4% surplus. The market still didn't believe them. It was the same at the MTBPS. And we're probably coming out now with, for the last fiscal year that ended in March, with a positive primary surplus of about 0.4% of GDP, given that little bit of upside in revenue, and given particularly they've managed to keep expenditure under wraps, particularly obviously given a very large wage bill increase that ended up being agreed for last year. And so basically, if you remember in the budgets, the Treasury sketched out this sort of path where the primary surplus will keep growing. The market didn't believe that, but is now having to reassess this after basically this upside surprise last year, after the strength of revenue, I think, versus market expectations, and the fact that the Treasury mechanism, I remember there are deep sort of mechanisms under PFMA about how they control expenditure, has actually worked in the last year. And I think there is a high degree of chance it can work, you know, through a messy coalition as well. So whilst we're not as quite as optimistic as Treasury, we're much closer to Treasury than in consensus in terms of the consolidation path that we see. And that's obviously positive for bond markets in the medium run.
And the better outcome, the less, you know, the lessening of pressure to borrow has nothing or something to do with the fact that they've been able to access the gold and foreign exchange reserve account in the Reserve Bank?
No, that's got nothing to do last year, right up to March. This has been unlocked now in this new fiscal year. So this is all underlying stuff. And I think this is the really important thing that hasn't fully been lodged. It's starting to get accepted, but not been fully lodged in the debate around Defectra, is that basically this, you're layering this on top of an existing moderately conservative fiscal path. You're layering on top of work going on in Treasury about putting in place a fiscal rule. That's all going to kick off from June, July in earnest as well. And so it's about cutting. So it cuts issuance around the edges of other things, this sort of non-SAGB RAND issuance, these sorts of things, which they're taking 90 billion out from that this year because of the money they're getting from Defectra. So I think there's been a lot of hyperbole in this debate. Treasury itself is keen not to show this is a free lunch as much as the SARB is as well.
Yeah. And you also talk colorfully, and I enjoyed it because I agree with you. That, and I'm going to quote you, we still have a smoldering radioactive waste pile, you say, that are the policies of the Department of Trade, Industry and Competition. Ibrahim Patel, one way or another, has been head of economic or industrial policy in the Zuma and Ramaphosa governments, I think, for about 15 years, and with very little to show for it. Or he publishes sort of uncheckable success figures about jobs created, or more often than not, jobs saved. But the industrial dial moves steadily downwards. What do you think is, what has to be done?
So these columns, you know, don't come out of nowhere. These views don't come out of nowhere. I mean, you know, having a lot of discussions, in the last week here, going around Joburg and Cape Town, but in general, you know, deep worry and dissatisfaction with the state of industrial policy, of trade policy, of this inward orientation towards autarky, from the DTIC, from businesses, from potential FDI, from current FDI people, this deep frustration. But the most interesting people I've been talking to are actually inside the ANC, inside the unions. They're also, I think, very upset with the situation on industrial policy. On the surface, I think they would notionally nod along, right, to what the minister said. But I think they've realized, you know, what on earth has happened now for the last, you say, 15 years of Ibrahim Patel's involvement. And I think there's a lot of political pressure building around this issue, around the edges. But my concern, I think the concern of a lot of people, is whilst there's a lot of sort of glib expectation maybe that he will be gone after the election, it's not clear that will be the case. He is very close to the president. He is trusted by the president, I think, despite advice the president gets to the contrary. And so we have to think, and I have to prepare clients, you know, for the fact that he may well be back, actually, as you know, concerning as that may sound.
I'm right in thinking that he's not on the ANC list, but he could be co-opted into the cabinet, right? Yeah, yeah. Okay, so he'd be one. Right. Of course, yes. Along with Pravin Gordhan, I think would be the other one. And you were a little bit skeptical about what might happen to the Public Enterprises Department now that Pravin is resigning or is retiring. That's a very messy thing, isn't it? Because there was a whole big kerfuffle couple of months ago about what would happen to the public. I mean, on the one hand, the ANC wants these public companies to go back to their ministries. There was another idea brewing about starting a new holding company for them all to be in. Where are we? Do you know? Can you tell us?
Well, remember the bill, this new SOE bill that was so contentious. The original draft was completely misworded on so many points. How you move debt around was completely mad. The whole thing was completely misconceived. The final version that went through cabinet was sent to the speaker, and then I think in February it was, and hasn't moved. The thing hasn't moved, and it hasn't been tagged to a committee, which is very rare. They normally get tagged to committee straight away. And I think what the ANC has done in the background, because actually Treasury was against this bill, is I think they've killed it. Because they know it's completely unworkable, even in its revised state, this bill. So, yes, the baseline is that the SOEs go to the line departments. But having said that, I think no work has been really done. I mean, there's been a bit of sort of background work by Treasury and some other people. But I don't think there's a policy where the president comes in. Remember, you're appointing a cabinet a couple of days after you've been elected by parliament, straight after inauguration. Yeah, we're talking like the 16th, 17th of June. There isn't this envelope you can open that says this is how SOEs are going to work, right? Here are your proclamations to change departments around, all this kind of stuff. And so, yeah, we're in this very weird no man's land on this issue where we assume they move, but we have no sense, really, that the groundwork's been laid for that.
So, I mean, what you're saying is that possibly after the election, what we might have is a real mess where there is no leadership at public enterprises at all, unless he, of course, appoints a new minister to it.
Yes, so that might be the default, exactly. If you haven't solved the problem of what has to happen to them, you just stick with the status quo, promising that you'll fix it in 6 months or so.
Yeah. Just to change tack a little bit and move away from the ANC, let's talk about the Democratic Alliance, the official opposition. Do you think it would accept an invitation to join a government of national unity? Let's say the ANC is at 45%, and the DA obviously gets it over the hump quite easily. What are you hearing? I mean, where would Cyril go? Would he scramble together something with small parties, or would he look towards the DA, and would the DA be interested?
So I think both parties avoid getting into bed with each other if they can, right? And at 45, they would be able to, the DA would be able to sit out, knowing that a smaller party coalition could be formed. And that would be fine. You form it maybe with the IFP, a few other smaller parties, but you scrape over the line. You get, 205 seats, that kind of stuff, quite noisy, potentially unstable. It's only really as you're getting down below 45 to the low 40s where there's the risk of the EFF coming in, where that smaller party maths doesn't work, where then I think the DA would have to go in and would accept going in at that level. So it depends where we come out. Our forecast for the election is about 44.1. So we're in a little bit of like dead zone or gray zone between these two scenarios where you can just make a smaller party coalition work, but the math is very, very messy and you need a lot of parties. So I think this is where the outcome is obviously important. But no, I think if under the right circumstances, I think the DA would go in, and particularly if they extracted the right minister positions and were able to form some kind of compromise on some key policy issues.
And how do you think the DA has performed in this election? I mean, it's to the extent that, election periods are probably more about just securing your base rather than persuading people to change their minds. But it's, from my point of view, it's just been the same old story. You know, you hit away at the ANC with corruption and mad policies, but there's not very much. I just wonder how much effort the DA is making to widen its appeal.
Well, it's not clear they're widening their appeal nationally a lot at all. There's an expectation management problem here. They want to sort of, and they're saying they want to get sort of 25% plus. We think they come in at high 22s. So a little bit up on last time, not dramatically, not as dramatic as maybe you'd expect, given the weakness in the ANC. They are doing well in KZN. I think that's where they potentially are reaching to new people. A provincial manifesto that came out as well, which showed a lot of serious thought about how to turn around governance in the province. In Gauteng, they're doing less well, with the dramas, obviously, of metros, etc., coming through. But no, I mean, they are certainly holding the line and doing okay, given budget constraints and all the rest. But I wouldn't say it's anything particularly to write home about.
And for finally, they have an economic policy worthy of the name. What do you think of it? You've had a look. I know you mentioned it in your column. I had a long chat to Matt Cuthbert the other day, the architect, the author of the policy. You've had a look. What's your early impression?
Well, I think the main thing is, regardless of if you disagree or agree with it, and we disagree with quite a bit of it, but it's a very long, lengthy, well thought together, you know, it hangs together policy. And it's very interesting. It's also very interesting, particularly on the DTIC policy. You know, it's very easy to hand wave at the DTIC issues, but they've done a lot of work to get into the weeds on those DTIC issues, and shows a lot of serious thought. we still think they are barking up the wrong tree on sort of no SOE bailouts. We think the SDG, alternative to BE, just simply won't work. It's the source.
Thank
of
you very much,
Chris.
I cannot thank you enough for saying that, because it's completely nuts to me, and I don't know why they. You know, I think Matt Cuthbert has found himself sort of stuck with this thing, which all happened before his time. And he's had to try and weave it in.
Yes, the key example, I think, is that there's so much, you know, washing that goes on, and sustainability washing that goes on in financial markets using SDGs, right? And you could do exactly the same thing. Because everything, you know, supports a bit of water here, supports a bit of sustainable livelihoods, right? You just sort of attach these things. And for us, you know, we think BE can be reformed. I think I've talked to you before about the idea of an upside-down scorecard. You focus on different things within the scorecard, etc. But no, I mean, I think the thing here is you have an interesting, you know, detailed alternative, looking through some of those niggles.
Peter, and finally, you led the column with one of my top five peeves about South Africa. Why on earth do people here put ice in their wine? What's wrong with them? Why would you dilute wine, for crying out loud? It's kind of normal in South Africa, but just tell me, I mean, it really isn't right, is it?
We could have a whole podcast about this. I have a dear lawyer, a very senior lawyer friend, who does this and does this at dinners. I've told him off in front of his clients at dinners about this, and it really grates with me. It's just as I think South Africans don't allow wine to age long enough as well. I think it's the same sort of thing. Respect for the grape, I think, should come first. But yes, this is an issue that keeps me awake at night, and is something that I often bring up with people.
Me too. Peter Attard-Modalta, thanks so much for coming on here to talk to us. And I would urge anyone interested in the South African political economy to read Peter in Business Day every Monday. It's always a treat, and it's been a treat talking to you all as well. Bye-bye for now. I'll be back next week with another episode of Podcasts from the Edge. Take care.